A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
For the many podcasts, not the few, strike up the band!
This is a completely pointless theoretical discussion.
So sorry that I insist that it fits the data, but it doesn't fit the data.
Well, if Nigel Farage joined the Green Party and then you're just like, ah!
Yeah, here we are again then. It's how to win an election, your insider's guide to a huge political year. I'm Matt Chorley, joined as ever by new Labour mastermind Peter Manson, Policy Mackenzie, former Nick Clegg's brain, and Tory brain box Daniel Finkelstein. How are we all?
I'm fine, thank you very much. Matt, how are you though? Because you have just finished the Rishi Sunak intermittent diet.
Yes. I'm all right. 36 hours without food is quite a long time, it turns out, particularly when my only hobby in life is eating.
He does actually do this because he came round to my house once on a Monday morning and we offered him some cake or a biscuit and he said, no, I'm on an intermittent diet. And if you're my size and you look at him, that just seemed completely absurd, but he was totally serious about it.
But that's kind of the point, isn't it? The thin people are the ones who manage their food intake. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So,
yes, I guess that's true.
I'm really very unsure about this Sunak fasting.
Yeah?
Yeah, I think it could have electoral implications. I think he looks like a stick. He looks too thin. I think it makes people feel that he's sort of a bit underwhelming. I think it sort of shrinks him. I just think
he'd be better if he was round.
No, I just think he would be better if he were just
a more substantial figure.
Well, I don't want to be sort of physicalist about this or fattist.
But didn't do George Osborne.
I actually think so.
George Osborne on the 5-2, that worked.
It did.
Well, up until the point when he lost his job.
I did just wonder whether Rishi really needed to do it. But it's...
Doesn't it also make him rather sort of tetchy and irritable?
I must admit, last night, I was really, really trying not to be grumpy at home, but it was difficult. I don't think I should have been, taking calls from Vladimir Putin at 7 o'clock last night.
Maybe they have, an emergency snack next to the emergency phone so that he can just, up his blood sugar.
There is another element to it, because I think those all things are correct, including the tetchiness from personal, from my own experience of doing things like that.
Do you get very tetchy?
Yeah, I can get tetchy when I'm trying to lose weight. But Rishi Sunak is just an extraordinarily disciplined person. That's the other thing. It's very interesting to watch, and I've rarely seen somebody so completely focused in the way that he is. There's some criticism of it, by the way. So some people think it's you're getting too much in the detail, like they said about Jimmy Carter, who ended up, I think, organising the White House tennis rotor all by himself. But he took everything into his control. But Rishi Sunak is very disciplined, and this is an element of that. So to keep on when you're that thin already with intermittent...
I think being disciplined is very good, if you're a prime minister. But if you're also so seemingly controlled and robotic... I think this is having quite an effect on his persona and how people view him.
My favourite...
I hadn't thought about this before.
My favourite reaction to it, because obviously it was in the Sunday Times that he does this. He doesn't eat from 5 p.m. on a Sunday till 5 a.m. on a Tuesday.
Does that mean he has to get up at 5 a.m?
Well, I thought that, because I went till 6. I wasn't set the alarm up to go up at 5.
Most prime ministers do get up early, though, because they have to work.
A Tory MP told the Times... Just summing up in one sentence, man, just everything, just have a go at it before everything. I'm sure banning vapes goes down brilliantly amongst the Californian fasting community, but our voters want the boats stopping and their wage packets growing. Just everything in a single sentence.
It is a bit of a sort of LinkedIn tech bro vibe, isn't it? You know? I get up at 3 a.m. No, I get up at 2:30
a.m. I'm a bit resistant to the idea that there's something that wrong with either either showing the self-discipline to do this or even being sufficiently capable of technology and understanding of the financial services that you could hold down a major job in California.
He just
seems to be quite a good qualification.
Peter's really warming to this.
No, I just think he's too much on autopilot. I think he just needs to be himself, relax, lash out.
This is himself. So that
this is getting worse and worse.
We've discussed this before about whether or not, you know, let Rishi be Rishi works because, you know, that might not be what they want. But we've had a question. If you want to email and get in touch with us, you can email us howtowin@thetimes.co.uk. Attach a voice note if you want, because then we can hear you as well, like this question from Mike.
Hi, all. The podcast is great. The debate is really insightful. But can someone ask Daniel what the answer is to the show's title, How to Win an Election? In each episode, Danny invariably comments that such and such will not change voting behaviour, or it will be marginal. Whereas Polly generally suggests that everything can change behaviour. Are they both right?
And just to give you a sense of what Mike is talking about, here is a flavour from just one episode.
I don't think any of these things, by the way, are election-determining issues. I don't think this is going to be an election outcome determining election. These don't affect the big results because very few things really do.
So, Danny, what does?
So I'm trying to distinguish between signal and noise, and there are various things that definitely are signal, one of which, the biggest of which, is the economy. And it's possible to win an election when you are not running with the economy. In other words, the economy is going well and you're the opposition, or the economy is going badly and you're the government, providing you find some other big issue which the other party can't follow. There's a very good book by a woman called Lynn Vavreck, an American political scientist, explaining what's called Why Message Matters. So she's arguing absolutely with me that quite a lot of these things that we discuss are noise rather than signal, but she doesn't argue, nor would I, that nothing makes any difference. And another thing, we've just been discussing an aspect of it, people's reaction to leadership makes a difference. So once people are determined that Ed Miliband, or in fact William Hague, whom I really liked, were not somebody they thought could be prime minister, none of the things that went up and down really affected the outcome, even though we thought they were going to. So all I'm trying to do, maybe I'm overdoing it, perhaps I am, but I do, because you know, certainly within Westminster, and that's important too, you know, somebody could be deposed. I always think of Dominic Cummings leaving 10 Downing Street with a cardboard box. You know, these up and down things did for him, and that was significant in terms of the theme of the Johnson government. So I'm not a nihilist. I'm not saying nothing matters. I'm just saying there are these big things, and I would say leadership, finding the big issue if the issue is not the economy, and the length of time the incumbent party has been in power. It's not that nothing affects apart from that, but those are massively the biggest things.
So, I mean, Danny's taking the Tolstoy position that great men do not affect history. I shall take the Karl Popper version, which is that they do and can. I guess, of course, Danny's right. Like, and you do get, if you spend time in the Westminster bubble, a sort of delusional belief that anybody other than you is paying attention to the niceties or who read which article or, oh, it must have been Kemi Badenoch that briefed that one. You know, like there's incredible amounts of noise. And yet that is the ecosystem in which leaders develop. And it's the ecosystem as well in which policy is forged. And those are the things that over time do agglomerate to create success or failure in the economy, success or failure as leaders. And so in a way, you have to bear in mind that, you know, the noise is the environment in which politics happens. And that's why, you know, when we were talking about by-elections, Danny made the point that correctly by-elections are a terrible predictor of voting behaviour. But because they sort of smash into that noisy, chaotic Westminster system, they can have all sorts of ripple effects that then somehow do, like the butterfly, create a thunderstorm.
I'm not sure you can make such a big difference between noise and signals. I mean, if you look at the government at the moment, there's an enormous amount of noise coming out of the government, out of the Conservative Party. All this sort of infighting and gossiping and backbiting and everything, and that sends a signal about the party that it's not fit for government anymore. Under Jeremy Corbyn, there's an enormous amount of noise came out of the Labour Party during that period, and everyone sort of read the signal quite rightly, which is, you know, that the Labour Party wasn't fit for office either. So, you know, noise generates signals which are picked up by the electorate and they draw the obvious conclusion.
But the most important of all is, again, as policy McKenzie, right, is that very often we get into this system where, because it's the big stuff that shapes the politics, that that leads to a certain kind of political activist, special advisor, minister, thinking that it's only the politics that matters and the governing doesn't. Mm. And that is one of the reasons why we're stuck in such a mess in terms of how the country's actually run.
Yeah, so I agree with that completely. I missed out, because obviously there's a link between what politicians do and then how it impacts on people's lives. But people notice it because of how it impacts on their life. I missed out one crucial thing, which is the assembling of demographic coalitions and how that changes. So the Conservative Party sort of, I've joked, made a decision to sack its old electorate and hire a new one. And it's finding the hiring process quite difficult. Whereas the sacking was easy. I think that when you're looking at these big political parties, they make a decision about who they want to represent, who they stand for. And the reason that Blairism was so successful, in my view, is that Philip Gould and Peter and Tony Blair, they all appreciated that its existing demographic coalition was too small and were trying to add on to it members of the middle class and appeal to those people. So that really, really does matter in an election. At the moment, I think Labour is going for a broader coalition. Keir Starmer's trying to see whether he can add voters without losing the ones that he's already got. And he's doing that, I think, reasonably skillfully. And the Conservative Party's engaged in a battle, really, over who its demographic coalition will be and could end up with nobody.
Yeah, it's called big tent politics.
Yeah. Well, we'll come to forming an actual coalition in the event of a hung parliament in a minute. Peter, I just want to ask you, with your as a former Northern Ireland secretary, a big moment that the Northern Ireland Assembly is coming back, but it's a huge moment that it means the first minister is going to be from Sinn Féin.
Oh, I think this is going to be a landmark development in Northern Ireland's history. I mean, first of all, you know, thank goodness the DUP, led by Geoffrey Donaldson, have seen sense and he's shown some bravery. Also, all credit to Chris Heaton-Harris, by the way, the Secretary of State, who has shown considerable patience and skill in getting the party to this point. But yes, it means that for the first time ever, an Irish Republican, Michelle O'Neill, will become the first minister in Northern Ireland. I think she will conduct herself well and sensitively in that role. And so too she might, because, you know, this is still fragile. But here's another point as well. During the course of the coming year, you're going to see an election in the Irish Republic, where I think Sinn Féin, the Republicans, are leading in the polls or very near, with along with Fianna Gael and Fianna Fáil. If the Sinn Féin play their cards right in Northern Ireland and it does them credit and status and they look as if they're, you know, behaving in a responsible way, this will broaden their appeal, other things being equal in the Irish Republic, and you could see them topping the poll in the Irish general election in the coming year. That, too, would be an amazing landmark development.
And does that then lead to a poll on unification?
No, not necessarily. That would depend on where the public go on both sides of the border. If the British government concludes from a consistent pattern of opinion polls that there seems to be an emerging majority in Northern Ireland for a border poll to take place, then they would be obliged to undertake one, but it wouldn't just be in the north, it would be in the south as well.
But do you think that's the direction we're heading in?
Not necessarily. But I think the DUP and I think the cause of unionism have done themselves quite a lot of damage by holding out against the assembly elections over the last 2 years.
Can I ask you a question? If there was this is an open question, not sort of angled, but if there was to be a border poll, that kind. Would the Labour government take a stance on whether or not there should be the Northern Ireland should remain inside the Union? Because our official position as a country is that we'd have no selfish strategic interest in the Union. So with Northern Ireland, so where would Labour go on it?
That would be the same. They would not campaign. They would not lean either way. Both parties have accepted, on the basis of the original Good Friday, Belfast Good Friday Agreement, that should a border poll, two border polls take place, north and south, then the British government would stand back and allow the public to have their say.
Well, it's fascinating. We'll see what happens. Because, like you said, it's a big year for elections, and one of those is in Ireland as well as in this country. Right, up next, we are going to look at coalitions, actual coalitions. How do you form one? How do you get on with your opponents? And who's got the best snacks? We'll do that next on How to Win an Election.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress.
It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
This is How to Win an Election with me, Matt Chorley, joined by Peter Manson, Polly McKenzie and Daniel Finkelstein. Now, we're going to talk about coalitions, not necessarily coalitions within within parties, but between them. We had an email from Tim O'Brien saying, could you do a programme on coalitions? Even the Labour and Conservative parties are effectively coalitions, but is that better than actual coalitions formed out in the open between parties? Now, Polly, this seems like a good opportunity to come to you first, having been involved in the formation of the last coalition.
I was. I'm a bit nervous that I might unleash some Mandelson snark because I know Peter has opinions about both the Liberal Democrats and the process that we went through in 2010.
I'm just warming up.
So just, you know, so in 2010, Nick Clegg had said, you know, sort of mostly defensively, but through the whole election campaign, we will see who has won the most votes and the most seats. And we pointed out that different parties could win the most votes and the most seats, and he just continued to say, most votes and most seats. David Cameron did win both the most votes and the most seats, and so Nick said that it should be for him to take the lead in deciding how he wanted to proceed and whether he wanted to form a coalition. That in itself was controversial because in as much as we have sort of assumed constitutional rules, it's that the Prime Minister's the Prime Minister until he's not the Prime Minister, and it should have been Gordon Brown who had the first opportunity. But so that we then started some talks with the Conservative Party on the basis of a document which was produced by their negotiating team, Oliver Letwin, I believe, did lots of the typing, drawing together.
In the run up to the election,
after the election. Okay. Once it was clear, no talks happened until after Nick Clegg had said for David Cameron to make the first move.
Conservatives had started thinking.
Oh, of course they had
before the election. Yeah, very important. Labour had not.
Yeah.
And he then gave a speech. Cameron gave a speech where he made, and that was written by Steve Hilton. He said he was going to make a big, open, and generous offer to the Double Democrats. They then made that offer. I collected a lot of documents in the middle of the night, but I'm pretty sure that I collected that offer document from Steve Hilton and Ed Llewellyn in the lift lobby of Norman Shaw North, which is one of the buildings on the parliamentary estate. I do remember that Steve was wearing shorts, of course, and no shoes.
And no shoes, obviously.
Ed Llewellyn was dressed immaculately, despite whatever hour of the night it was. But that might have been the confidence and supply agreement. I don't know, my memory's blurred. But essentially, we started a process facilitated by the Cabinet Office of actually negotiating with the Conservatives. And we started basically with the easy stuff. We started with, for example, the green energy transition, where actually, because of where Cameron was and where Oliver Letwin was and where the Lib Dems were, that was an easy conversation. And we slowly built up a programme that was based on the things we already agreed on, which was really the compassionate conservative stuff that Cameron had been talking about, to build a sense of momentum. And then we got to the stuff where we were stuck. And that's when it was clear that we were stuck on things like electoral reform or tuition fees. And that's when it seemed sensible to open talks with the Labour Party. This is where Peter comes into the story. We also got a document. It was written by Gordon Brown, or at least it had gone to him because it was in his characteristic font, thick, bold type because of his eyesight difficulties, offering, by contrast, almost nothing. The offer that came in from the Labour Party was, we will continue with the Labour Party's programme of government and we'll have a review of electoral reform and a review of votes at 16, possibly a review of local government finance, because they really knew how to tap in with I don't know, I didn't keep the document, but it was very much a sort of, yeah, we'll sort of review a few things that we think that you care about, by contrast. But there were talks. Peter was involved in those talks. Those talks were held in one of the corner rooms in Portcullis House. I didn't go into the room for those conversations. I was in a room
just the lads.
Just the lads. I was in a room next door. So
actually, Harriet Harman was there.
Of course. Yeah, we know. She told me yesterday. She said, "I have a meeting with only men in the room."
But there were a series of conversations between the Labour Party and the Lib Dems, but they were always much more cursory. Gordon Brown then, I think, in order to facilitate those talks, I know Peter will have much more insight into Gordon's thinking at the time, possibly to unlock a coalition because it seemed like the Liberal Democrats would get into bed with the Conservative Party. Gordon Brown resigned. David Cameron went to the 1922 committee and persuaded them that the only way to get into power was to offer this AV referendum to the Liberal Democrats. They came back to us with that. By this time, nobody'd really slept for 72 hours. At one point, I booked a taxi for, like, the next morning, but it was already 2 a.m., so the next morning was... So I was standing outside my house at 5 a.m. waiting for the taxi, and I realised I'd booked it for the next day. So that's the level of high-quality thinking that was going in. But essentially, that tipped over the edge for the parliamentary party, the Liberal Democrats. So we had a series of kind of big meetings of the parliamentary party. At that time, what, 52, 54 Lib Dem MPs plus our peers. Those were held in Westminster Hall.
I remember loitering outside that.
There was a lot of loitering, lots of traipsing back and forward into the Cabinet Office and secret things. There were a couple of phone calls between Nick Clegg and David Cameron. I remember one moment, and this is an important moment for me because people so often say that Nick Clegg and Danny Alexander did that deal to get ministerial cars, as if the car is the thing that matters. But anyway. I've very clearly heard Nick and David Cameron talking. It was just me in the office with him. And Cameron was only had one side of the conversation, but Cameron was trying to get Nick to talk about jobs. because he thought he could get the Lib Dems over the line with just jobs and Nick
in government.
Jobs in government. Like, I don't know precisely what he offered him, but Nick would not take jobs. He wanted policies. Oh, yeah. Classic Lib Dem. He wanted policies.
Who had the best snacks?
Oliver Letwin brought the snacks himself. Viennese biscuits. They're sort of like chocolate sandwich biscuits. Mm-hmm. Every time I eat those, I think of Oliver Letwin.
And Labour snacks?
No snacks, I believe. No snacks
Peter.
At all.
Doesn't
always
take,
bring
doesn't
snacks.
Take much to buy off the Liberal Democrats, does it? Just as a couple
I
of
think
Viennese
I was the only
biscuits.
One who ate them.
Yeah. Look, what Polly says in essence is all perfectly correct, but let me just boil it down to two essential,
I'm trying to tell a long story
two
like you do,
essential
Peter.
Dynamics. One was the sort of burgeoning public schoolboy bromance between Nick Clegg and David Cameron. Nick Clegg definitely didn't want to jump into bed with Gordon Brown.
Well, that's because he'd just lost the election, though, was it really? Going into bed with the guy who'd been in power and, for such a long time.
Yes, big factor. Come back to that. But secondly, the Liberal Democrats were using the negotiation with Labour in order to bid up what they could get out of the Tories. So I don't think they were ever seriously negotiating with Labour. Sure. I think they were seriously negotiating with the Conservatives, and they were using us to get a better deal. But let's be quite clear about forming a coalition. It takes three things. The arithmetic has to be right. There has to be a policy overlap, an agreement. And thirdly, the personal chemistry has to be in the right place. In 2010, the arithmetic was not really in the right place. We had undershot. We were about 10 seats short of what we needed to negotiate seriously with the Liberal Democrats. As Polly says, Gordon Brown's policy offer came a little bit late, rather half-baked. He hadn't anticipated this and started to pave the way for it, unfortunately, although I think he made a rather more serious set of constitutional reform proposals than Polly is giving him credit for. And as for the personal chemistry, I mean, I remember sitting in one of those meetings with Gordon Brown on our side, Nick Clegg and Danny Alexander on the other. And we were talking, going round, talking about various things. And suddenly Danny opens his mouth and says, look, let's cut to the chase on this, Gordon. The fact is that we don't like you and we don't want to serve under you. And my sort of mouth slightly dropped open and I sort of deflected the discussion in order to sort of smooth over the temporary embarrassment of Danny's sort of rather sort of direct observation. But that's what it was about. You know, they didn't want Gordon. The policy wasn't seriously gone into and the arithmetic didn't add up.
I think that's all obviously right, but I think it underplays the achievement of both Nick Clegg and David Cameron. Let's just, in forming that government, but let's concentrate on Nick Clegg, because if you contrast it with what Jeremy Thorpe did in 1970 when the Liberal... 74. When the Liberal... Liberal Party, yeah, when the Liberal Party found itself in a similar position, you can see Nick Clegg was very well prepared. He had thought of, you know, this formulation, for example, that he would negotiate first with the party with the most seats. The fact that he and most votes, the fact that he'd boiled down the priorities so that he knew the core things that he was negotiating. He had some clear idea where he was going to move. All these things, you know, because the Liberal Democrats came out the other end and lost a lot of seats, there's a tendency to think, well, the whole thing was a complete flop. Well, Nick Clegg is the first and possibly last leader of that party in a century to gain power. And it was a real achievement, which he gained through clear thinking and quite a lot of courage at the end of the day. Now, the other thing on Gordon Brown, I know that you added the word public school in to make this bromance thing sound worse, but the, because it's for everyone's favourite thing. It's like, oh, no.
Are you denying the bromance?
Yes,
no,
I really,
I'm not denying
really
the bromance.
Are you denying the...
You're denying the bromance.
Yeah,
come on, Polly. They were just...
I saw them together a lot. Of course.
Exchanging vows in the Rose Garden.
No, I think they managed...
The dynamic of that was bromancy, bromance light. But the way they operated together was always professional. They did have that ability to to collaborate and to talk honestly and openly with each other, but they were never friends, yeah. And they were never, no, and they're not friends now.
I would agree with that, and I think, but I think on the question of Gordon Brown, I mean, for large parts of your own political career, you found getting into bed with Gordon Brown difficult, right? Even though you were trying, even though you were trying quite hard, Peter. So
I think it was a bit the other way around, but let us not rake over the coals.
No, exactly. It was the other way around. I completely take your part in that argument completely. What I'm saying is that he's not an easy individual, and if the Liberal Democrats concluded that a relationship with Gordon Brown would be hard, you know, well, Patricia Hewitt found it hard. Jeff Hoon found it hard. James Pennell found it hard. David Miliband found it hard. So, of course, the Liberal Democrats would find it hard because he was a hard person. So I think the fact Cameron was easier to have a relationship with was a factor.
Dan is rightly described 2010 as a sort of watershed sort of development for the Liberal Democrats. It might have come all the way at the first book end of the New Labour government in 1997, because there... Paddy Ashdown, the leader of the Liberal Democrats, and Tony Blair had been talking and preparing and paving the way for a good 2 years for the possibility of a coalition should the 97 election not give a clear-cut result. So there was a lot of meetings and dinners and going out and discussing policies as well. Personal chemistry could not have been better between Ashdown and Blair. But here's the point. The third issue, arithmetic, we completely overshot the runway in 1997. And the would-be coalition or governing arrangement between the two parties was unsellable to both parties.
Personal chemistry and policy, but the maths didn't work in the opposite
arithmetic
direction.
In the opposite direction.
There's another thing which is important, which is Nick Clegg positioned the Liberal Democrats differently to previous leaders that came before him and came after him. He was nearer to a centrist leader, to what people think the Liberal Democrats are. But in fact, they're most of their history are part of the centre-left, as they were at the formation of the Labour Party and as they are now. And that means that this question going forward, the Conservative Party, unless it can reach into the 40%, is going to find it difficult to coalesce with anyone.
Blair saw this in great historical terms. He thought this was an opportunity in 1997 to overcome the previous 100 years of fissure division between the two centre-left parties, which in his opinion, I agree, had basically given the Tories almost the century of government. And so, in a sense, what he wanted to do was not so much coalesce with the Liberal Democrats in 1997. He wanted to hoover up the Liberal Democrats in 1997. He thought, you know, the SDPers who had broken away in the 1980s, the Liberal Democrats who were basically left to centre, that they should all be sort of subsumed into this huge New Labour big tent. And he regretted afterwards, actually, that he missed that opportunity.
But fortunately,
because it really would have changed the landscape and changed the face of British electoral politics.
Fortunately, we're now in that position, right? So the Liberal Democrats, admittedly, they've made this head-spinning decision to stay outside the government they're going to help Keir Starmer form by defeating the Conservatives in large numbers of places. It's a view I can't understand, but I suppose is mandated by the fact that they've got a separate political party. But I think that, by and large, this experience of coalition has now reunited the centre-left parties. They're just going to run in different places, and ultimately it's sort of like an informal Lib-Lab
pact. You see, coming to the present, this year and the election taking place later this year, I think people are not pricing in sufficiently the possibility that Labour may fall somewhat below the result that the opinion polls are currently indicating they will obtain. These are artificial. This is an artificial lead, believe me. It's going to contract. And if you consider the swing that is required by Labour to get an overall majority at the election, it's something like 11 or 12%.
12.7,
This is huge. And so I think that we should, I think, well, to be honest, I think there are some in my own party, there are also the Liberal Democrats, who should be just thinking...
Well, should they be doing... Should Starmer's team be doing some of the work that the Oliver Letwins and David Cameron's had done?
Yeah.
At least think having it as an option in the drawer, preparing for the possibility of a coalition?
I must say, I think that the likelihood of a formal coalition is small. I think you're more likely to see the sort of arrangement that emerged following the 1974 elections, which Danny referred to earlier. Jeremy Thorpe chose not to prop up Ted Heath and his government because he thought that that government had been rejected by the electorate in February 74, but the electorate had also showed that they were unsure about Labour. Mm. They were not confident about ushering in a majority Labour government, and that was the result that was reflected in that sort of rather nuanced state of public opinion. By the way, I think in 2010, just as the public rejected Labour and Gordon Brown, they were equally unsure about the Conservatives. They weren't completely convinced about Cameron and Osborne. And, you know, the electorate shows an uncanny knack of sort of getting the result that it sort of wants. And that's where the Liberal Democrats come into play. And what you might find this year is if Labour falls back from its current lead, if Labour fails to maintain its present momentum and political appeal, you may find the Liberal Democrats doing better than expected, and a result is somewhat more ambivalent in reality than the opinion polls are currently suggesting.
Polly, so what would if Peter's saying that Labour should at least think about it, should the Lib Dems be doing the same thing?
Well, I'm sure they are, but it depends really how the Labour Party is thinking. If you're thinking in grand kind of hegemonic historical terms, then sure, finding a way to coalesce Liberal Democrats and Greens into a kind of centre-left movement post-election would probably be a good idea. I don't think the Labour Party is thinking in that way. And of course, that's the opposite to what the Liberal Democrats would probably ask for, which is some kind of electoral reform. The Labour Party, we have to assume there will be a chunk of SNP MPs, maybe not quite as many, but a chunk. And they have said that they will not support a Conservative government. And that means that the path for Labour to just sort of bulldoze through as a minority is pretty clear, and it's the path of least resistance.
Yeah. The Labour Liberal Democrats will not constrain a Labour government. No. They will do the opposite of that. Their critique will entirely be the Labour Party has not gone far enough on green politics. It's not gone far enough on whatever it wants to do on the Constitution. It's not spent enough in certain areas. It will be the opposite. If people are thinking, well, you know, we're worried about a Labour government becoming too left-wing. I don't think they are worried about that, actually, by the way, but I think if they were, and the Liberal Democrats will constrain it because they're the centre party, that is not the dynamic. Actually, the Liberal Democrats, at the moment, you can hold the view of the Liberal Democrats, official view, and be a member of the shadow cabinet or cabinet, but insofar as a separate party, they have any, it will always be to pull the Labour Party to the left.
Poor Lib Dems, poor Red Tony. Just on the subject of the bromance, Polly, I've looked up a story, one of my favourite stories from 2010, when Nick Clegg told The Sun that he'd been building an IKEA cupboard with David Cameron for baby Florence to put her...
Yeah. Told you,
I saw that cupboard.
That's all I need. That's the proof.
I'm sorry, but if your romances including building IKEA furniture,
they were putting IKEA together,
seriously, right? There is something wrong with you.
Okay,
like, that is not a romantic. I pity you.
David was very proud of that cupboard, I remember.
Let's hear from you and the questions that you've sent in. This one is from Catherine, who's a fan in Paris.
Hi, How to Win team. My name is Catherine and I live in France. And like many expats, I've been out of the UK for more than 15 years. But now, thanks to new legislation, I will be able to vote in the upcoming general election, which I am very happy about because many people like myself actually couldn't vote in Brexit, things which directly affect our rights. So there are millions of people like me, and my question is, how do you think this could affect the upcoming UK general election? Also wanted to say I'm a big fan of the podcast, and especially Peter.
Oh!
Well, you don't have to sound so surprised.
So go on then, Peter. Tell Catherine, first of all, what difference is her being able to vote going to make?
Hi, Catherine. I love you too. I think your vote is going to make a difference. And I think I would be more worried if I were a Conservative than Labour, because I think a lot of expats feel let down over the government's negotiating expat rights following Brexit.
Polly?
I think that we shouldn't have changed the rules, and we should change the rules in the other way, and that actually we should have people who live in the UK voting about the future of the UK, more of them, people with permanent right to remain and definite leave to remain. And people who, like my mother, who's lived in France for 25 years, like, she should vote in France.
Yeah, yeah.
It's weird.
Danny?
I don't think this will make much of a difference.
Oh, surprise!
No, seriously, I don't think there's any reason to think it will be systematic.
Yes.
Right. The crucial proviso is I don't know how large it is. Obviously, large numbers of people voting will make a difference, but yeah. I don't know how.
But they'll also be spread right across the country because it's the old seat that they used to live in. There we are. But I feel like we ticked off all the boxes there. If you'd like to send a love letter to Peter Madison, you can email howtowin@thetimes.co.uk. Attach a voice note. We can play it next week. Next week, we'll be back with a box, hopefully with a box of chocolate Viennese Wells from Polly McKenzie. That was How to Win Election. I'm Matt Chorley, with Daniel Finkelstein, Polly McKenzie and Peter Madison.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel, a pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.